Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, well, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Color.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the dough. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the dough? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect know-how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Aside from the obvious destruction and violence, the most frustrating thing about the last week of riots is the incoherence, the lack of explanation for what exactly the grievance is and what exactly we can all do about it to address the issue constructively.
Welcome to Comic Tropes. I'm your host, Chris. There is a question I have asked myself many times as a comic book reader, and that is, why aren't there more Jewish superheroes? Because when you look at the history of comic books, from the 30s through the 60s, every key character in superhero comics was created by a Jewish creator. Everything in the Silver Age and Golden Age is by Jewish talent, and yet none of those superheroes are Jewish. So why is that? Well, today we're going to try to get some answers there. And I won't have a lot in the way of a definitive answer because I can't find any interviews where the creators themselves were asked this question point blank. But we can look at the history of comics, the history of America, a few anecdotal pieces of interviews by some of this talent, and we can try to fashion our best guess. Now, before we go any further, I think we should level set by establishing who are some of these key characters I'm talking about and the sort of big moments in comic book history that were created by Jewish talent. So we're going to get into that, and unless I specifically mention otherwise, you should assume that every writer, artist, editor, and publisher that I'm going to mention was Jewish. We should begin by noting that the first comic books came out in the 1930s and they were published by a guy named Max Gaines. He began reprinting comic strips from newspapers in what we now recognize as the comic book format. Max established Entertainment Comics, or EC Comics, and his son, Bill, later inherited it and changed it to Entertaining Comics. That became popular throughout the 40s and the 50s with books like Tales from the Crypt. When the Comics Code and government pressure made horror unpopular, he changed his popular comedy comic, Mad, to a magazine to avoid regulation. Mad is still published today and has long been a publication built by urban Jewish cartoonists. Max's early Funny Comics reprints were massively popular, and many rival publishers sprouted up, many of them also Jewish, because other creative fields in the 1930s were not readily available to Jewish people at the time due to a general anti-Semitism in the professional workplace. But by the mid-30s, a lot of the comic strips had already been reprinted and publishers were looking for new ideas like war stories and science fiction. The first superhero comic, Superman, was published in 1938 and was created by writer Jerry Siegel and artist Joe Shuster. This ushered in the popularity of superheroes as the dominant genre in comics. It was quickly followed by Batman by writer Bob Kane and artist Bill Finger. In 1940, The Spirit was created by Will Eisner. Another important character created at this time was Captain America in 1941 by writer Joe Simon and artist Jack Kirby. We'll come back to discuss these characters and their creators in greater detail, but there are some more key milestones set by Jewish creators that we should look at. In 1956, DC introduced a new version of The Flash, Barry Allen, which represents the start of the Silver Age of comics. He was created by writer Robert Kaniger and artist Carmine Infantino, who was not Jewish. But editor Julius Julie Schwartz was, and he had a hand in the creation. A massive amount of Flash's stories for the next decade were written by John Broome, also Jewish. In 1961, the team of Jack Kirby and Stan Lee began the Marvel Age of comics with the creation of the Fantastic Four. The two Jewish creators went on to co-create Thor, the X-Men, the Hulk, Nick Fury, Black Panther, the Inhumans, Iron Man, and many more. In 1976, Chris Claremont began writing X-Men. In addition to being Jewish, he created Kitty Pryde, a Jewish member of the X-Men, and revealed that Magneto was a Holocaust survivor, explaining his hatred for humanity. In 1978, Will Eisner published what most consider to be the first graphic novel, A Contract with God. In 1980, Art Spiegelman began publishing Raw magazine, featuring the work of many Jewish cartoonists and the first chapters of Mouse. Spiegelman was among other Jewish creators like Trina Robbins and Harvey Pekar that kept the underground comics movement that was prominent through the late 60s and 70s going. Spiegelman's Mouse was eventually published in 1986 as a graphic novel and was Spiegelman's account of his family's escape from Nazi Germany, which would go on to win a Pulitzer Prize. In 1988, Jewish writer Neil Gaiman began his acclaimed run on Sandman, which would occasionally address themes related to Judaism and Kabbalah, or Jewish mysticism. And on top of all that, we had prominent Jewish publishers of comics like Harry Donenfeld and Jack Liebowitz of DC Comics and Martin Goodman of Timely, which ultimately became Marvel. It was Jewish fans that organized the first comic book conventions. And there have been many prominent Jewish directors who oversaw some of the biggest superhero movies, like Superman director Richard Donner, Spider-Man's Sam Raimi, and X-Men's Bryan Singer. So now that we've established some of the most prominent characters and their creators, we're still left with the question, why didn't they feel the need to make any of these characters Jewish? And to answer that question, we're going to have to look at overall American history at the time. So why, first of all, were so many Jewish people working in comic books? Well, that's because a lot of creative avenues were closed off to them. Newspapers and radio businesses were simply anti-Semitic. Ad agencies in the 30s and 40s frequently had anti-Semitic quotas to prevent too many Jewish people from working there. So you had teenagers that were the children of first-generation immigrants, just coming out of the Great Depression, struggling to put their creative skills to use to escape poverty, and not many options. But comic books were new. Comic books were desperate for new material. Comic books became a welcoming new option that was pioneered by Jewish creators. Now we have creators like Siegel and Shuster pitching Superman. But even though the comic book publishers were happy to work with them, American readers did not have an appetite for Jewish heroes or stories. And on top of that, people like Jack Kirby and Will Eisner saw themselves as Americans first and Jews second. The fact was, these people were all culturally Jewish, but they weren't necessarily Orthodox or conservative. It wasn't that their religion wasn't important to them, but these people were coming from families who had sacrificed a lot to move to America for new opportunities and safety from Europe's wars. They wanted to assimilate. They wanted to be accepted. So it wasn't the time or the place to create a Jewish Batman or Captain America. Instead, their experiences would become coded into the creation of superheroes. Let's start with the harshest example. Jewish people then and now deal with competing stereotypes. One is that they are weak and ineffective, and the other is that they somehow have the power to control the world behind the scenes. Conscious decision or not, this idea seems to be present in many superheroes. Clark Kent walks around as a mild-mannered reporter, but his Superman is more powerful than anyone. Steve Rogers was a sickly weakling before being transformed into Captain America. It's a trope of superheroes in general. Peter Parker, Bruce Banner, and Tony Stark are all men of science with passive demeanors or serious injuries, but are secretly powerful beings that can reshape the world around them. Some parts of the Jewish experience may or may not have been intentionally added. For instance, Superman is sent away from the dying planet of Krypton to Earth. Was that a mirror of Siegel and Shuster's parents leaving Eastern Europe for the Western world? Was it a thinly veiled parable like Moses being sent down the river by his mother? Maybe, maybe not. Simon and Kirby have Captain America punching Hitler on the cover of his comic. But in 1940, America was largely unaware of the extent of the Nazis' atrocities and how many millions of Jews were being killed. There were rumors, and there was a large amount of anger at Hitler and his army for the war that they were spreading, but that was an American thing in general in 1940. Still, it's possible rumors from European family members or familiarity with the Old Testament could have informed some of these creators when making new superheroes. One popular theory is that Superman is an evolution of the Jewish concept of the Golem. The Golem is more of a monster, but is also a protector of the Jews. It isn't a perfect fit for Superman, but Will Eisner has said in interviews that he believes it was a conscious derivation. Over two decades later, Lee and Kirby created Benjamin Jacob Grimm, the Thing, a powerful rock monster and a member of the Fantastic Four. This is a much more similar idea to the Golem. And yet, Lee and Kirby weren't explicit about Thing's religious background. And it wasn't until 2002 that writer Carl Kessel made it canon that Thing was, in fact, raised Jewish. One element that plays strongly in many superhero stories is the idea of being an outsider. Especially many of the Marvel superheroes like Spider-Man, Hulk, and the X-Men feel like they aren't quite accepted by society. And the men behind these characters certainly had to deal with those feelings as they worked to assimilate into modern America. It's a bonus that many teenagers have the same feelings, which made them relate to the stories and become loyal fans. In Danny Fingeroth's book, he argues that the very concept of a secret identity, which is a trope for superheroes, probably came from the Jewish creators feeling the need to play different types of roles in different circumstances. One at home, one at work, one out in public. Ultimately, it's my belief that Jewish creators didn't feel the need to make their superheroes Jewish because they were trying to assimilate. However, that means that today there are very few prominent Jewish superheroes. Even when a Jewish actor plays a superhero on screen, their Jewishness is invisible. For instance, Scarlett Johansson and Jon Bernthal are Jewish, but Black Widow and Punisher certainly aren't. There are prominent Catholic heroes like Daredevil or Muslim superheroes like Ms. Marvel. But, quite ironically, Jewish characters remain very quiet in the comics. In closing, I can only think of two prominent Jewish superheroes. I can think of The Flash and The Thing. And both of those are relatively recent developments. Barry Allen was hinted at being Jewish around 1988. And The Thing wasn't canonically Jewish until 2002. So it really makes you wonder, okay, comic books, the comic book industry, and superheroes in general, there's no question that that was all created by Jewish creators. They had the biggest hand in all of this. They built it. And yet, there's very little in the way of representation for them now, today. It may be time for us to honestly take a fresh look at superheroes and reconsider what kind of place and representation Jewish people have in superhero stories. I hope you enjoyed this look at a historically interesting part of comic books. I know it's not as jokey and funny as some of my episodes, but it was something I really wanted to dig into. And couldn't find much in the way of definitive answers, but I definitely found out that there's no question that these creators were growing up in anti-Semitic times. So it just wasn't a popular environment for them to say, oh yeah, Captain America happens to be Jewish, Batman happens to be Jewish. It was an interesting topic to look at. I am on vacation for the next 2 weeks. I'm going to Japan and Hong Kong, but I've prepared ahead. I've got two really ridiculous episodes in a row for you. And if you are one of my patrons on Patreon, I've actually also created exclusive episodes for those 2 weeks for my patrons. So yeah, I've created a backlog of episodes getting ready for this trip. Please, if you haven't, please consider taking a look at my Patreon. We also have polls, I have blog posts, things like that that are exclusive, and you can become a supporter for as low as $1. It would really help me, especially in situations like this where I'm going on a trip. You know, if I want to spend some money on a comic book abroad or record over there, it all goes into production of the show. Just something I hope you'll consider, but I really appreciate you tuning in for this episode. That makes me sound old, tuning in. Nobody tunes in anymore, do they? We tap buttons, we type. We don't tune anything anymore. All right, so I'm ending this episode.
My home is not for sale, and if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe.
What Jim Salit is talking about is the city of Lakewood, Ohio, taking his house, his home, through eminent domain to make way for a high-priced condo that will pay the city more in taxes than he and his wife Joanne do. And he says he's not going to take it lying down.
It's a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
I'm Mike Wallace.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Ed Bradley.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl. Those stories and Andy Rooney tonight on 60 Minutes.
Just about everyone knows that under a process called eminent domain, the government can and does seize private property for public use to build a road or a courthouse. But did you know the government can also seize your land for private use if they can prove that doing it will serve what is called the public good? Cities across the country have been using eminent domain to force people off their land so that private developers can build more expensive homes and offices, which will pay more in property taxes than the buildings they are replacing. Under eminent domain, the government buys your property, paying you what is determined to be fair market value. But now, people who don't want to sell their homes at any price just to see their land go to another private owner are fighting back.
The bottom line is, this is morally wrong, what they're doing here. This is our home, and we're going to stay here, and I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
Jim and Joanne Salida, refusing to sell the home they've lived in for 38 years in a quiet neighborhood of single-family houses in Lakewood, Ohio, just outside Cleveland. The city of Lakewood is trying to use eminent domain to force the Salitas out to make way for more expensive condominiums. But the Salitas are in effect telling the town, hell no, they won't go.
We talked about this when we were dating. I used to point to the houses and say, Joanne, one of these days we're going to have one of these houses. And I meant it. And I worked hard.
What'd you do?
I worked in the pharmaceutical industry. And we worked very hard for this and paid it off. And we said, oh, we've got it. We paid off our home. I retired. And now we're going to spend the rest of our days here and pass this on to our children.
But Lakewood's mayor, Madeline Kane, has other plans. She wants to tear down the Salitas home, plus 55 homes around it, along with four apartment buildings and more than a dozen businesses, so that private developers can build high-priced condominiums and a high-end shopping mall, and thus raise Lakewood's property tax base.
This is a project.
The mayor told us she sought out a developer for the project because Lakewood's aging tax base has been shrinking, and the city simply needs more money.
This is about Lakewood's future. Lakewood cannot survive without a strengthened tax base. Is it right to consider this a public good? Absolutely.
What you're saying effectively is that the Salitas neighborhood has to be sacrificed for the greater good of the city of Lakewood.
I guess I'm saying that that neighborhood is being asked to, and it's difficult and it's unfortunate that they are being asked to give up their home.
They want this whole area because of the view of the park.
Well, it's a beautiful view.
It is an awesome view. They know it's gorgeous, and they want it. It's that simple.
This whole area is called Scenic Park, but that's the problem. Because it is so scenic, it's a prime place to build upscale condominiums with great views over the Rocky River. Those condos will be a cinch to sell. But the condos can't go up unless the city can remove the Salitas and their neighbors through eminent domain. And to legally invoke eminent domain, the city had to certify that this scenic park area is really, quote, blighted.
We're not blighted. This is an area that we absolutely love. It's a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And, Mike, you don't know how humiliating this is to have people tell you you live in a blighted area. And how degrading this is.
You're the mayor. You know the place. Tell me what is blighted about that area.
The term blighted is a statutory word. It really doesn't have a lot to do with whether or not your home is painted. It is a legal statutory term.
Meaning?
That is used to describe an area. And the question is whether or not that area can be used for a higher and better use.
What does that mean, a higher and better use? What's higher and better than a home?
The term blight is used to describe whether or not the structures generally in an area meet today's standards.
And it's the city that sets those standards. So Lakewood set a standard for blight that would include most of the homes in the neighborhood. A home could be considered blighted if it doesn't have the following.
Three bedrooms, two baths, an attached two-car garage and central air. Now, this community is over 100 years old. Who has all those things?
You mean it's blighted if it doesn't have three bedrooms?
Those things I just told you. That's the criteria. And it's ridiculous.
You don't have central air?
No, and we don't need it because of the air. We always have a breeze.
Sure.
Right off Lake Erie, the breeze comes right through here all the time. We counted all the attached garages in Lakewood. There's 20 in the whole city.
We counted 20.
And by the way, we got up at a meeting and told the mayor and all seven council members their houses are blighted according to this criteria.
My understanding is that using the criteria that are in place, more than 90% of the houses in Lakewood could be deemed blighted, including the houses of the mayor and of every one of the city council members. True? Do you have two bathrooms?
No.
Blight. Two-car garage?
No.
Blight. Is the garage attached?
No.
Blight. And your lot size is under 5,000 square feet?
Oh, well under.
You've called that area a cute little neighborhood. You didn't call it a cute little blighted neighborhood. I mean, you and I know that it's not a blighted neighborhood.
I would never personally walk that neighborhood and indicate that that neighborhood is not attractive or, I mean, I would never say that.
It's a cute little neighborhood.
It is a cute little neighborhood. You'll get me to say it on the record. It is a cute little neighborhood.
Cute? Maybe. But without those new condos, it won't produce enough property taxes to satisfy the mayor and the city council.
That's no excuse for taking my home. My home is not for sale. And if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe in the whole country, not only Ohio, but this is rampant all over the country. It's like a plague.
This is a nationwide epidemic. We have documented more than 10,000 instances of government taking property from one person to give it to another in just the last 5 years.
Dana Berliner and Scott Bullock are attorneys at a libertarian nonprofit group called the Institute for Justice, which has filed suit on behalf of the Salites against the city of Lakewood. They claim that taking private property this way is unconstitutional.
It is fundamentally wrong and contrary to the Constitution for the government to take property from one private owner and hand it over to another private owner just because the government thinks that person is going to make more productive use of the land.
Everyone knows that property can be taken for a road, but nobody thinks that property can be taken to give it to their neighbor or the large business down the street for their economic benefit. People are shocked when they hear that this is going on around the country.
And it's not just people's homes that are the targets in these eminent domain cases. The Institute for Justice has also filed suit against the city of Mesa, Arizona, to save Randy Bailey's brake repair shop, the shop he got from his father and hopes someday to pass on to his son. The city of Mesa, citing the need for redevelopment, is trying to force Bailey to relocate to make way for an Ace Hardware store that would look better and pay more taxes.
Redevelopment to me is, work with the existing people there and redevelop.
Right.
Not, you get out, we're bringing this guy in.
Bailey's Brake Service has been on this corner for more than 30 years.
In Mesa, this is the corner, Main Street and Country Club. There's not a better corner in this city.
And business has been pretty good down the years?
Business has been awesome.
Now, what used to be in all of this property? I mean, everything else has disappeared.
The city come in and got immediate possession and started demolishing it, making it dirt.
The city has made dirt out of three restaurants and four businesses that once stood on this five-acre lot.
And it's not just business properties that they're doing this on. You know, they wiped out eight people's homes over here. You know, your home ain't even safe.
Bailey told us his neighbors let the city buy them out. But he's refusing to sell.
I'm standing in their way. I'm their thorn in their side.
A thorn in the side of Ken Linhart, who owns the Ace Hardware store a few blocks away. Linhart wants a much bigger store. He could have negotiated with Bailey, but instead, he convinced the city of Mesa to try to buy Bailey's land through eminent domain and then sell it to him.
The city of Mesa wants to move Mr. Bailey about a block away And from what I understand, it's going to be a new building, new equipment, moving expenses, and everything set up for him. I don't see how Mr. Bailey's going to get hurt.
You can't replace a business in the same location. This place was built in 1952 as a break-in front-end shop. I don't care where you move into City Mesa, it would never be the same.
So Bailey went to Lenhart looking for a way to stay on his corner.
I tried to go to him and see if we couldn't work something out on this, and he told me, no, there ain't room for you there. We're going to let the city just take care of you.
Did you ever sit down and try to negotiate with him?
No, I never did.
Redevelopment seems to me to make obvious good sense. But the right of eminent domain to take one man's private property, Randy Bailey, to give it, in effect, to Ken Lenhart for his private property.
It happens all over the country. Practically any town you want to go to, they're redeveloping their town centers.
Right.
Now, are we going to sit in Mesa, Arizona, and have our town center decay? As a citizen of Mesa, I don't want that to happen.
If I'd had a for sale sign out there, it'd been a whole different deal. And for them to come in and tell me how much my property is worth, and for me to get out because they're bringing in somebody else, when I own the land, is unfounded to me. It don't even sound like the United States.
And this isn't happening just in small towns. Right here in New York City, a few blocks away from Times Square, New York State has forced a man to sell land on that corner over there that his family had owned for more than 100 years. And what's going up instead? A courthouse? A school? Nope. The new headquarters of the New York Times.
It seems the world's most prestigious newspaper wants to build a new home on this block. But Stratford Wallace and the block's other property owners did not want to sell. Wallace told us the newspaper never tried to negotiate with him. Instead, the Times teamed up with a major real estate developer, and together they convinced the state to use eminent domain to force Wallace out by declaring the block blighted.
I challenge them. This is not blighted property, nor is this property over here blighted.
But New York State Supreme Court disagreed. The court ruled that the newspaper's new headquarters would eliminate blight, and that even though a private entity, the New York Times, is the main beneficiary, improving the block would benefit the public. New York Times executives would not talk to us about it on camera. Back in Lakewood, Ohio, Jim and Joanne Salid are still waiting for their court decision. Most of their neighbors have agreed to sell if the project goes ahead, but the Salids plus a dozen others are hanging tough.
I thought I bought this place, but I guess I just leased it until the city wants it. That's what makes me very angry. This is my dream home, and I'm going to fight for it.
Now the fight is moving to the ballot box. Lakewood residents opposed to the development have gathered enough signatures to force a citywide referendum on it come November.
Okay, today, just a short rant because we're going to cover this more in detail as we go week by week. Social capital banking. That is essentially getting your property built or even renovated. Instead of using banks, traditional finance companies, traditional mortgage companies, government programs and all that, friends and family, your social network. Your social network should be that as such where if you want to build a house, you can build a house and you don't have to go to a bank or you don't have to go to the government. You don't have to go to social services. You don't have to go to FHA, VA, or whatever these other programs out there. You have enough friends and family to put together your project. So every Thursday, and that includes this Thursday, we're going to have a building project. The ultimate goal is to produce at least one tiny house from scratch. On Thursdays, we will not be able to produce that this Thursday, but we're going to start with something. So the whole thing is, because he had DIY, which is Do-It-Yourself Housing TV, which is an updated name from It's My House, is to essentially teach people how to build their own house using social capital. That's our financing mechanism. That's our banking mechanism. social capital. What can we do with our friends and family? If you don't have friends and family sufficient enough, then we'll teach you on how to get some. How to get some and how to maintain them. Okay, because this is, once you get a friend, you need to maintain that friendship. All right, so that's it for today. Now, tomorrow we have a guest, very interesting guest. So if you're interested in making money, particularly dealing with housing, tune in tomorrow for a very interesting guest. And then we also have a guest coming in on this coming Thursday. All right. And we'll tell you what our project is for the week on Thursday. Social Capital Project will be on Thursday. But we also have a guest who will give us information on ways to make money that way, too. So, let's see. You know what? I forgot. I can't end the program unless I play. I got to go to Jamarian Styles. So let me find where he's at. Okay. And, all right. Yeah, we got to have the no excuses in here. All right, well, look, if you got anything you want to put out there, give us a call now, 619-768-2945. You got 2 minutes and 55 seconds.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Styles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out. He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer at the buzzer. Jamarian Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?